Africa?
Yeah. Thank you. We'll first talk about the Africa update, Agenda Paper 12. The committee, as always, had a very productive and busy meeting in June. They finalized 4 agenda decisions, issued 4 tentative agenda decisions, and also discussed 3 other topics, 2 of which will be discussed later in this week's meeting. These include the proposed amendments to IS 23 on borrowing cost and modifications of financial liabilities that do not result in derecognition. I'll first briefly talk about some of the finalized agenda decisions, which starts on page 5 of the IFRIC update. The first agenda decision I'd like to highlight relates to IF 41, biological assets, which is on page 7 of the IFRIC update. The submitter asked the committee whether fair value measurements for a particular type of produce growing on bearer plants is clearly unreliable. While the committee determined its role is not to conclude on very specific application questions, particularly when they relate to the application of judgment, the agenda decision includes some helpful explanatory material. Feedback on the tentative agenda decision for this matter highlighted some areas related to the valuation of biological assets that can cause difficulty in practice. The committee requested that we highlight these matters to you for consideration as part of the PIR on IFRS 13. Some of the challenges encountered include assessing the particular point in time in the growth cycle when a fruit or a biological asset is considered to exist separately from the bearer plant. Secondly, whether the capacity for transforming an immature fruit to a fruit ready for harvest is a characteristic of the fruit or a characteristic of the bearer plant. And thirdly, whether and how cost included in valuing a growing fruit should reflect the use of the productive capacity of the bearer plant, sort of like an amortization charge. We have relayed these challenges to the IFRS 13 PIR project team. The second agenda decision I just want to highlight relates to IS 33, earnings per share, which is on page 6 of the IFRIC update. The committee finalized an agenda decision including explanatory material. In this particular instance, they also decided to publish an example that will accompany the agenda decision. The example illustrates how an entity applies the explanatory material in the agenda decision. It will be published on our website together with the agenda decision, and we also expect it to be included in the Green Book. I'll just pause here for a bit and ask if you have any questions on any of the finalized agenda decisions. All right. Moving along to the tentative agenda decision, as I mentioned earlier, the committee published 4 tentative agenda decisions. For 2 of the tentative agenda decisions, the one on IFRS 3 for acquisition of a group of assets that is not a business, and the one on IS 37, cost included in assessing whether a contract is onerous, the committee has tentatively concluded that in each instance, a reasonable reading of the requirements could result in entities applying one of 2 possible approaches. For each of these issues, the committee also went on to consider whether it should undertake standard setting to eliminate one of these possible ways of reading the requirements. However, the committee tentatively concluded that the criteria for adding these issues to its agenda, to a standard setting agenda, were not met, and that is explained in each of the agenda decisions. In addition, the committee also reconsidered how an entity accounts for the acquisition of an associate or a joint venture from an entity under common control. It published a tentative agenda decision that includes explanatory material on how an entity would account for this transaction. I will stop here and ask if you have any questions on these tentative agenda decisions or even on any other matters included in the IFRIC update.
No questions?
Move on to paper 12A.
Thank you.
We will now move on to Agenda Paper 12A, which analyzes feedback on the proposed amendment to ICE 12. A summary of the proposed amendment and the feedback are described in paragraphs 8 to 15. 50 respondents commented, and we received general support for the proposed amendment. We also received feedback from GPF members at its March meeting. Many GPF members agreed with the amendment. Some members suggested that the board consider possible consequences on an entity's effective tax rate and on earnings per share. Some members also said it might be difficult to assess whether a payment is distribution of profit. There are two main issues raised by respondents. The first issue related to how to determine whether payments are distribution of profit. Paragraphs 16 to 18 describes the feedback on this issue, and our analysis is outlined in paragraphs 19 to 29. When developing the proposed amendment, the board discussed this issue, and for the reasons described in paragraphs 19, decided not to provide any requirements. We continue to think that any attempt to define a distribution profit goes beyond the scope of this annual improvement and could have unintended consequences. Consequently, we recommend not providing requirement on how to determine whether payments are distribution of profit. We also considered whether to finalize the proposed amendment without additional requirement in this respect. We think finalizing the amendment as proposed would be an improvement to existing requirement, even without the requirement on how to determine a distribution of profit. Consequently, we recommend that the board reaffirm the proposed amendment. I would like to direct your attention to question 1 on page 7 and ask if you agree with the recommendations.
All agree? Yes?
Okay.
Go on.
Okay, thank you. The second issue is about transition. The board proposed a retrospective application of the amendments. Some respondents suggested the board reconsider the transition requirement. Paragraph 31 to 32 explain the concerns raised, and our analysis is in paragraph 33 to 36. We think the benefit of retrospective application would not outweigh the cost. Consequently, we recommend requiring an entity to apply the amendment prospectively from the beginning of the earliest reporting period presented. I would like to direct your attention to question 2 on page 9 and ask if you agree with our recommendation.
Mary?
I'm fine with the recommendation. I just had an observation and a question I meant to ask before, which is the observation is it seems very clear from the feedback and your analysis that retrospective would be very high cost and have some questionable value. I think if we could just you go away offline and think about how we can maybe improve the analysis when we're doing the ED so that we think anticipate that a bit more in terms of the what we exposed, that would be great, because when I looked at the analysis, I'm like, yeah, that seems pretty straightforward as reasons not to. And the second is I can't remember anything in the paper about whether the interpretation committee had any recommendations. I thought with AIPs that there's a discussion with the interpretation committee, but I'm not sure about that.
In this instance, so sorry, you got a bit of a mix this month, actually, because
okay.
The next paper we're going to talk about, ICE 23, yes. We did discuss with the Interpretations Committee last month coming forward. This one, in re-deliberations, has come straight to you. There is a reason. And basically, so this one did come through the Interpretations Committee in the initial instance, because the initial question came in as a question to the Interpretations Committee. But the reason that we've brought it straight back to you as a board, there's probably two reasons, by the way, but the main one, in a sense, is that when on sort of initially in proposing the amendments, the committee did discuss it and give some recommendations to you, but also the extra discussion around dividends and distribution of profit happened at the board table, in a sense. So if there's something extra, in a sense, that comes out of the board, just in terms of sort of efficiently moving the process forward, they sometimes go back to the board.
Stephen?
Does this not have a direct influence on the net income time series? I mean, if somebody's going to have to change as a result of implementing, of doing this, then some tax is going to move around. And that changes effective tax rates, it changes net income, it's going to affect the time series. And if it's material, it would seem that retrospective application doesn't have limited value. It has the same value that you would expect it to have in any other situation. So I'm not quite sure why retrospective application has limited value in this case when it has such a impact on net income.
Well, so it could affect net income. So that's why we recommended a prospective application starting from the lowest comparative period. And when it comes to periods before the lowest comparative period presented, if an entity has previously recognized tax effects of payments of financial instruments classified as equity directly in retained earnings, for which it had recognized transactions that generate distributable profits directly in profit loss, we thought there wouldn't be any difference between which is
okay. I've misunderstood. It doesn't actually affect the time series at all, does it? It yes. just affects the opening balance, and it's in equity anyway.
Because the comparatives adjustment.
Yeah, because our recommendation does go prospective from the beginning.
And we'll explain that.
Yes.
Because.
Sorry, I understand that.
We go ahead with the IS 8 amendment. People are going to be looking to analogize to our thinking in different standards and that to say, oh, well, you did prospective in that case and that was fine, so you know my situation is similar to I'll do prospective now. So I think we have to be very careful to explain
prospective
why.
The beginning of the comparative.
Yeah.
Exactly. And I think what you're saying is explain then the reason why we've gone prospective from the beginning of the first comparative
deals
period
with the
to ensure.
Series,
yeah.
Actually.
With that explanation, do we support that recommendation? Yes.
Yep. Appendix A to the paper summarizes other matters raised by respondents together with our analysis and recommendations. I would like to direct your attention to question 3 on page 9 and ask if you agree with our recommendation on the matters outlined in Appendix A.
Do we agree?
Yes.
Okay. Next paper.
Okay.
Thank you.
12B.
Thank you. We will
again. Yeah.
Yes. We will move on to agenda paper 12B, which discusses the proposed amendment to ICE 23. The proposed amendment clarifies that an entity treats any outstanding borrowing made specifically to obtain a qualifying asset as part of general borrowings when that qualifying asset is ready for its intended use or sale. The amendments affect how an entity calculates the capitalization rate to be applied to expenditures on qualifying assets that are funded from general borrowings. The amendments could have a material effect mainly in situations in which the interest rate on the specific borrowings is significantly different of the interest on other general borrowings. 51 respondents commented on the proposals, and they generally supported the amendments. The committee discussed this feedback at its June meeting. The main matters identified by respondents, together with the committee's discussion and recommendations, are summarized in paragraphs 14 to 31. The committee recommends that the board finalize the proposed amendment and in doing so clarify the rationale for the amendment in the base for conclusions and that entity includes funds borrowed specifically to obtain an asset other than a qualifying asset as part of general borrowings. I would like to direct your attention to question 1 on page 9 and ask if you agree with the committee's recommendation in respect of the main matters.
I think we do.
I agree with the recommendation, but let me think about the consequence of this amendment. So in most cases, I think the capital ratio will rise. Is my understanding correct? I just want to test. Because the in normal circumstances, if you have a qualified asset, it's a long-term, normally long-term, long-hold asset. And the interest rate is normally higher than the general borrowing. So if we allow this amendment, then normally the capital ratio will rise. Is my understanding correct?
I think that will very much depend on the borrowing rate, on the general borrowing versus the specific borrowings. And it could be affected by when they took out the borrowing. If the general borrowings were taken out a few years ago, the interest rate could have been quite different.
Yeah.
So it would really vary, I think, depending on an entity's facts and circumstances.
Yeah, I think so. It depends. But normally, if you have a qualified asset, it's a long-term asset, right. Whereas the general borrowing is kind of running to compensate running. So then, my question is, we proposed the amendment to IS 16, which is we allow recognizing revenue within the testing period. So that means less capitalization from revenue. So that means minus capitalization will not happen. Whereas this amendment will increase the capitalization of from the expense. So if you take it as a set, so what kind of message are we proposing? So that's the reaction of the constituents. So if I were the manufacturer and I have a kind of assets, long-term asset, and then I think it's a qualified asset, and then it has also testing period. And then if I take this amendment and another amendment on IS 16 as a set, then you will recognize more revenue, you will recognize less expense. That means, ISB is proposing a little bit more aggressive accounting. And my fear is, are we proposing, more aggressive way, or we do not have such a strategic message, but my fear is constituents may take that recent ISB has a kind of strategic view that proposing to shifting to the more aggressive account.
The one thing I would say on these amendments is these are not creating any new requirements to capitalize anything more or less than you previously did. These amendments are just simply clarifying what's already in IS 23 and what the principles are in IS 23. So to me, I don't view this as taking a step towards asking people to capitalize more. Mm-hmm. That may just happen because of the current economic environment we are in, which I think is different from us asking people to do more expense capitalization. I'm not sure if you want to add anything on that.
Yeah, I suppose that was just what I was going to say as well, Javed, is that very often, of course, you're right, when we bring these sort of very narrow scope amendments, this case this is an annual improvement as well, very, very often, at least almost all the time, I think that I've been bringing these to you, is we're not creating anything new or fundamentally rethinking requirements. It's often just we've had a question into the Interpretations Committee that says there's a bit of a lack of clarity about exactly how to apply the requirements that are there. So all we're doing is trying to clarify, take away any sort of confusion that there might be without sort of fundamentally rethinking it. I mean, the amendment amendments to PP&E are slightly different. Still the same background, is still a question that's come in, and the reason we're proposing amendments to I-16 is very much about addressing identified diversity in practice, hopefully to get to a better place. But
I totally understand. I fully agree with you, but just I read the Wego's decent comment and about IS-16. He talks about consistency with the IS-23 and wondered whether are we providing some strategic message or not. And we definitely we are not. We are just simply clarifying it. So we have to cast that message to the constituent. Thank you.
Gary.
As you're aware, I agree with the conclusions. Just want to make one comment and just one question just to make absolutely certain I have it right. I mean, the closer and closer the borrowing rates get, the less important this becomes. The specific asset and the general pool asset, if your borrowings have the same rate, there is no issue. But now when I have a very specific borrowing, say a mortgage, so I'm building a building, but eventually the building goes in service. And that mortgage at that point becomes part of the general borrowings pool that doesn't stay outside of it. I don't know if that's out of this amendment or that's out of, the underlying standard. That's what I thought the answer is. This is a good clarifier then.
Yeah. Mary?
I wanted to check something, which is question 1A says, agree with the clarifying the rationale. Am I correct in looking at paragraph 22 as the one that really sets out what the rationale is that you would be capturing? And if I am correct that that's the rationale, I support going ahead and finalizing this. But if we're going to spell out the rationale, I think rather than just explaining the words that are there, I think it might be helpful on the basis to go back a bit further, in the thought process, because to me, the reason for saying it moves from specific to general borrowings after the qualifying asset is put in service is because of the fungibility of cash and it's providing financing to the entity, so it does form part of the borrowings. And what's in paragraph 22 is more about the mechanics.
Yeah, I think, correct me if I'm wrong, gentlemen, I think almost what we're going to draw out is almost more what's in paragraph
21 and 22,
but 21's an important part, I think, for the reason that you say, Mary, because cash is fungible. There is kind of an underlying sort of principle behind IS 23 that pretty much you put, you put everything into your general borrowing.
And I think we have to do it carefully, as of course you always would, because we don't want to give people the idea that if you can rebut the presumption of it being a fungible pool because it may be in certain restrictions, it's just conceptually that it's funding for the entity. Okay, fine.
Agreed.
Appendix A, this paper summarizes other matters together with our related analysis and recommendations. The committee agreed with our recommendations on these matters. I would like to direct your attention to question 2 on page 9 and ask if you agree with the committee's recommendation on the other matters outlined in Appendix A.
Agreed?
I have three comments, observations on this one. First thing is, if you see page 11, our respondents suggest many issues on IAS 23. Some of these issues are quite valid, it seems to me. So these issues must be researched further, maybe at a different process. So these are suggestions. We should respect. That's the first comment. May I keep going on there? Second comment is, if you see, this is page 13, the issue of mandatory prospective application. So I suggest, as this one respondent suggested, the default method, the retrospective application, must be permitted at least. So as Steve just said before, the other case, the income tax effect on the issue is these two applications, retrospective, prospective application, there are no big differences in that case. But this case might be different. So I suggest you think about allowing the retrospective application in addition to mandatory prospective application on this issue. The second one, the third one, finally, if you see that page 14 of the top, one respondent said it would be inappropriate to require entities already applying IS-23 in line with the proposed amendment prospectively. So our response is very clear. This is because they are doing this issue prospectively, there's nothing to do for us to do now, right? But strange, it is very strange. Why this respondent suggested this kind of a comment? Because it's too clear. So I'm just curious about why this respondent suggests this one as an issue. So these are three observations.
I mean, Sean, I'll maybe start at the end and work backwards. So obviously we don't have any great insight into the last one. We were equally surprised. Every time we propose any change to our standards, then if you are already doing whatever we're suggesting, then clearly transition doesn't apply. There's nothing to do because you're already doing it. So the fact that somebody raised this was equally a surprise to us, but it's not unique to this, which is why we don't think there's anything in particular, hopefully, to do about it.
This is clarifying in nature. So yeah. We would expect to have many people doing the right thing.
Exactly. And as you say, Amara, for the reason we said often the nature of our narrow scope changes are often clarifying. So by definition, we'd expect, you know, quite a few people to potentially already be doing what the amendment is just providing extra clarity to. I suppose just to provide context for when the board, you know, vote on this is the reason I think that we haven't... When, at least as staff, we come along and think about transition now, one of the rightful things we've heard sometimes in the past is, are we overcomplicating transition? And particularly when we think about very narrow scope amendments. So, of course, we could add endless options on transition, but we at least now try to think about not adding extra optionality on transition if we think people are simply not going to take that because it makes the transition requirements actually more complex than just going. So I suppose this was one place where I think we thought anybody who does have to amend something to comply with these amendments just wouldn't want to. There'd be so few people, if anyone out there, would actually actively want to retrospectively apply it, that we didn't see that there was any real benefit including that, just given that it does make the transition requirements more complex. So that's just a thought for you to vote. And I suppose the last thought in paragraph 11, as you rightfully say, you know, people have raised various other things, and I think I'm not being critical. I think it's natural that when we propose any amendment to a particular standard, in this case it's IS-23, if I were a respondent as well, I might choose to, as narrow as we might write the amendment, even though we say it's an annual improvement, we're just clarifying this, we didn't look wider, I think it's quite natural that often people decide in response to that to tell us all the other problems they think they have with that standard. So I suppose for completeness and for clarity, we make sure we capture those comments to give you the opportunity to see whether you agree with us or not. But I suppose if we looked down this, a lot of this is just something that we think is not part of the scope of what we're doing, and it's just where one or possibly two respondents have raised another concern. So we don't necessarily think at this stage, unless we hear something else, that there's further work to be done around these.
So if I repeat that Steve's question, there's no significant net income effect on this transition application in a prospective or retrospective, so there's no big differences in the net income. So you are saying you don't need to this thing is complex, right?
Well, I think, Javed, you correct me if I'm wrong. I think there could be some effect, but I think we just thought that a fully retrospective approach in this instance would mean it would be potentially so costly to go back who knows how long in time, that there is possibly some effect, but we thought maybe the effect is not necessarily going to be that significant compared to the sheer cost of having to go back for a very long time and work out these particular borrowings.
Wouldn't materiality deal with that? This is my concern sort of on this analysis, that it is so costly, didn't think. But surely there needs to be an analysis of the benefits, because that's what potentially we're asking people to do in this IAS 8 amendment.
But I think you did in proposing this, yeah. Because if we think about the effect, so it means potentially going back, as I say, for how long, we don't know, investigating what were your qualifying assets, did you have any borrowings that were specific to the qualifying assets, they extended beyond the end. If I had, if I had then included that in my general borrowing pot, would the differential between the rate at which I'd borrowed specifically for the qualifying asset really make any difference to my general borrowing rate?
I don't disagree in this situation. I think
it
is clearly going to be very expensive, because potentially you're going back a long, long way to long-lived assets, redoing all these calculations.
And I think, but just to the reason I was explaining, it's to come back at the end of it and actually say, look, it's hard to know or understand. It would be very difficult to do that, even at least the potential is it wouldn't really have any very material effect, but we don't know. We just know to assess that.
And I also think transition requirements could get complicated further, because there is transition relief for first-time adopters to apply from the date they transition, or they can pick an earlier date. And if we potentially allow fully retrospective, again, people who are transitioned at a particular date, we would then have to then also have an option for them to go back only till the date when they applied IS-23 from. So we just thought that would just complicate the whole transition requirement significantly. And I think, like Katrina said, we just didn't see enough benefits to users of having people go back and adjust for this.
Mary?
Commenting on two of the points that Chung Wu cited. One is this point on page 14. When I read that comment again, it sounds to me as if the person who sent that comment might have been misunderstanding what we meant by prospective, i.e. that they'd have to go back and restate prior periods to apply the wrong answer.
Yeah.
And so I think in the basis for conclusion, you could say that the board did this so that you would only apply any change in the policy prospectively. I'd say don't screw up the wording of it in the text itself, but just highlighting that it's the change that you're talking about. And then in page 11, Item A, you did highlight something for me about paragraph 21 and 22, which is I presume that the test of the ability of the entity to repay is a financial resources test. It's not a legal and contractual ability. So while I agree with the staff in terms of the appendix, in terms of not giving guidance on each of these issues, if this is really solely a financial capacity analysis, it might be good to bring that out. It won't answer definitively every one of those questions, but it might help give people an understanding of what kind of capacity to repay analysis people are thinking about.
I do think, Mary, I think what you're highlighting is that with some of the clarity, hopefully we can give around why this amendment is happening, and that more sort of general principle about how IS-23 works, that you're kind of you put all of your borrowings into the general pot except anything that's that is specific, then a number of these points that are raised sort of on page 11 will actually indirectly hopefully
I agree with now marching through and answering them, but I had always read paragraph 21 as a theoretical financial capacity to repay, not having to analyze the terms and conditions of every loan you had to see if there's early repayment possible.
Do we agree with the staff recommendation?
Thank you. So paper 12C discusses the possible effects of the amendments to IFRIC 14. With this paper, we wanted to inform you of information we received from UK stakeholders about the likely effects of proposed paragraph 12A of these amendments. As background, IFRIC 14 clarifies how much of a surplus an entity can recognize as an asset. Paragraph 11 of IFRIC 14, which is reproduced in paragraph 7 of the paper, specifies that an entity has an unconditional right to a refund in three situations. Proposed paragraph 12A of these amendments aim to clarify that an entity cannot assume gradual settlement, that is, paragraph 11B of IFRIC 14, when other parties have particular settlement rights. In these situations, an entity would generally assume full settlement in a single event, that is paragraph 11C of IFRIC 14. So why does this matter? Well, this matters because the measurement of the asset assuming full settlement in a single event is different from its measurement assuming gradual settlement. Assuming full settlement, an entity has to include cost of settling plan liabilities in measuring the asset ceiling. This is not required when an entity can measure the asset ceiling assuming gradual settlement. So this amendment could result in some plan recognizing a significantly smaller asset. In addition, for some plans, an entity may have an obligation under a minimum funding requirement. The amendments could result in some portion of that minimum funding requirement contribution being recognized as a liability if that contribution would not be recoverable once paid. Appendix B summarizes the interaction of the asset ceiling and minimum funding requirements in IS 19 and IFRIC 14. Paragraph 19 and 20 of this paper describe some typical characteristics of defined benefit plans in the UK. Stakeholders asked if the board intended proposed paragraph 12A to apply to these plans. Our analysis is presented in paragraph 23 to 30 of this paper. In our view, the funding level of a plan does not affect an entity's assessment of its unconditional right to a refund. We think plans with the characteristics that are described in paragraph 19 and 20 are within the scope of proposed paragraph 12A of the amendments. In addition, the paper goes on to consider some scenarios to assess whether and when entities may have to recognize additional liabilities for minimum funding requirement contributions. I will stop here and ask if you have any questions on the possible effects of proposed paragraph 12A of IFRIC 14 to defined benefit plans in the UK.
I'm out. Thank you. Thanks for the paper. I think it's a very good paper. And I understand the objective of the educational objective, let's say. My question is much more generic. You at some point here, I took note that this effect that you anticipate of we were told would have is concentrated in the UK, and then you say at the very end that your proposal is to explore this further. So maybe two questions or one forever. Is your idea to explore in this consultation with stakeholders only the UK, or do you also intend to seek if this is also possible to
exist in other places, because the paper gave me the impression that we would only seek the UK effect. So this is one question. And the second, about the effects the board envisaged. So the B on paragraph 41. So do you intend to assess only under the potential effect that we are identifying here, or you are envisaging a broader analysis back to the origin of our proposal?
So I think I'll answer. So I think that Amaro, our main objective actually with our consultation is actually to find out about effects outside the UK. So I think this paper, we think we've got, from information we've heard, we've got reasonably good information on how it will affect plans in the UK, which is spelled out in this paper. Now, what we had heard during the development of these amendments is that we think it has the most significant effect on plans in the UK, but I think we just feel it would be helpful to know a bit more just about, you know, now having, I suppose, explained hopefully more clearly in this paper as well, how we see that effect working and how, you know, what are plans with particular characteristics, how they are affected. We would hope to consult with people in other jurisdictions just to find out what the effects are in other jurisdictions.
So it will be not only concentrated here.
Correct.
So because I think that's important. Sometimes we identify one particular jurisdiction is more vocal, but then the issue can be common in other jurisdictions as well. Since we decided to do that to take more time.
Yeah, exactly. So.
Correct.
And with regard to the second question.
Yeah, I think that's where, I suppose it's now, again, it's all, I suppose we split it into A and B, but it's a bit combined. So now understanding, now that we have a better understanding, I suppose, of how it's going to affect UK plans and hopefully, you know, have a discussion here about whether you think that's appropriate from your amendment. Once we find out, you know, more about the other jurisdictions, that built into that is maybe just understanding how the pensions, for example, legislation and things work to, I suppose, just ensure that then what we find out, what are our overall or expected effects from the amendment and what we always expected is kind of going to happen, having a better understanding maybe of how some of the pensions legislation works.
Gary.
Thank you. I agree with the staff's conclusions and recommendations in here. Just a couple of comments from prior life and then just one or two clarifying questions. In prior life, we had several dozen defined benefit plans, most of which were funded, and funding and actuarial all worked for me. I can assure we looked many times, can you revert surpluses? And consistent with paragraph 31 of the UK is once money is in the bank, it is very difficult to get out. So I think this is a broader issue than, you know, just the UK. Now, how prevalent it is broadly or how much monetary amounts are affected, I don't know, but it is more than the UK. But generally, once the money is in the trust fund, especially if it's a tax-advantaged one, it basically, the liabilities have to be satisfied, settled, protected in some capacity. So as I, UK phenomenon is not alone. It makes sense to me. And it's also hard to get the money back. You know, sometimes you can adjust future contributions as a way to, sort of backdoor way get it, but that's problematic. It's very timely. It's very time consuming, I should say. I think to me, paragraph 31 in your paper is the most important in terms of summarizing why we are where we are. I think towards the bottom of page 8, we said you can't assume a refund based on a gradual settlement, and that makes sense to me because pension plans are long-term propositions and actual gains and losses need time to net themselves out. So it makes sense to me that you can't count that. And same time, if the assets in the trust fund are protected, but also the second half of paragraph 31 makes sense is if you want a refund, you've got to assume that liabilities are settled in, you know, the a single event. You know, to me, there might be a series of several events, but the principle is it's you settle it en masse. And there is a cost to doing that, your settlement losses or gain, and I think that makes total sense, should include in the surplus computations. The one question that's not in here, what if you had a settlement gain? I don't think you've increased the surplus out of it. I think we just ignore it. I think that's what this gets you to, but I think I just want to clarify it was right on that, because one who's, you, somehow the debits always seems to hurt you, but the credits are oftentimes not always available to you. But I think the final document should make it clear the reverse is not true. A settlement gain does not increase your surplus. In there, if it's not clear in 19 or in the amendment as it is, I think that's important to get in. And do think some of the hydraulics in your examples, particularly example 2, they're sort of hard to follow, you know, even for people who are close to this stuff. And I would prefer an example attached to it. I know that's perhaps not, you know, where the staff is thinking, but particularly following example 2, that is not easy to follow the ins and the outs as you go through it. You've got to spend some time getting it clear. And as I told you, I know a lot about this stuff, and this was hard to follow. And I'm trying to think of everybody else out there, so we should work a little bit harder on the drafting on that when we get to that point. Thank you.
So if I look at the question that came in from stakeholders in paragraph 21, where they asked if the proposed paragraph would apply to these plans, I could read two things into that question. One is, did you really mean it? And I think the analysis, my response to that would be yes, and I think the results are appropriate. So, but the other thing I guess you could read into that question is, when they read the words, they weren't clear if that they would have reached the same conclusion that it would apply to them. So is there something we're planning to change in the drafting to make it more clear that it would apply to them, or is it more a discussion on the basis? What are we planning to do to help them connect the dots that the way the staff have in the paper to reach the conclusion that it does apply?
One of the things we are clarifying in drafting is from where this question arose as to what did you mean when you used the word wind up in that proposed paragraph 12A. And that is certainly one thing which we've discussed, and we will be clarifying that. And when we explain in the basis why we made that clarification and what effects we think it will have, we will bring in some of this information that we think should bring clarity around how entities should account for plans with these characteristics.
Okay. So it's beyond us just discussing it at the table and saying, yes, that's how they should have read the words. It's more we're going to try and reflect it better in the draft. Thanks.
And I think both, by the way, in the drafting of the proposed amendment and the authoritative words, as well as an extra explanation of these.
Thank you. That's similar to Tasu's comment and Amaro's. So on your next step, one of your next step, you are going to consult with the other jurisdictions whether they have similar issues or not. It seems to me, regardless of what result of this kind of a further survey, I don't think you are going to change any conclusion here, right?
Well, we don't. That's certainly not anticipated at all. It's simply that, I suppose, having heard what we already heard, and I suppose what we often hear from stakeholders is they're like that when you make changes, the worst thing you can do is make a change and it's not clear exactly what the change is or what it affects. And I suppose having heard this, and hopefully we saw benefit, I suppose, in spelling out, like we did in this paper, in the context of these plans, how the, you know, what are the effects of the amendments. And we just thought, having done that, it would be beneficial to do that outside just the UK as well, to make sure, because it, you know, the amendment itself could look, and it is just in theory just clarifying in nature, it could look like something very small and just clarifying, and we think there are real benefits to being clear about how the amendment would affect plans. So there's certainly no anticipated change anywhere other than finding out.
So this analysis is really well done to show what the dramatic difference between the paragraph 13 and paragraph 14 of IFRS 15, IFRS 14. So these are two different type of pension plan with a gradual settlement and a full settlement. There are totally different accounting. So the two balances of these two approaches are so different, dramatically different. So I thought, you know, maybe our standard has some kind of weaknesses in dealing with this issue in accounting terms. So I thought your next step to explore some kind of a little bigger amendment of IFRIC 14. That's why I asked whether you are not going to make a more deeper research on the issue of the different accounting in paragraph 13 and 14.
That's certainly not part of our plans or staff at the moment. I mean, that would mean making the project a different project, I suppose, in a sense. So again, whilst I just explained to you that we wanted in this instance to spell out the effects, in theory, the starting point of this was the same, very much a clarifying question that came into the Interpretations Committee. And it is right to characterise it as an amendment that just tries to clarify requirements that are already there. And it really is, you know, very fine-tuning, you could say, in one sense. But because of what you said, because it can result in some plans being measured in quite a different way compared to what they are before, it could have in numbers quite a big effect, which is why we thought it made sense to explain it. However, the nature of the amendment is still a very narrow amendment and simply trying to clarify words that are already in IFRIC 14, as opposed to, you know, opening up and, say, re-looking at how the measurement works.
Well, in fact, the point I wanted to make is, in a way, the one that Matrina has just made. I think in this context it's very important to be clear that we are just clarifying something that already existed and not decided on making a change to how things had to be accounted for. And even though, I mean, the basic conclusions could highlight the issue on the paragraph 13 in relation to how it restricts its scope, I mean, you could stop there because it was just the scope of this amendment to clarify one point and not reopen all the issues.
Yes.
I think it's very important to state that, in fact, it's, and the effect that we're seeing, I guess that to be described as the effects of eliminating a diversity in practice that has been at the origin of this clarification to start with.
Yeah.
Any other questions, comments? No? Okay, then we're done with the implementation issues. I suggest we take a 15-minute break, 10 to 3.